Joe, how you doing?
Tim, I'm doing well. I received a lot of criticism, personal criticism, in the last week, more so than even normal, because I bought this electric car and people were upset about this, and I just wanted, do you mind if I take like 20 seconds and just point something out? Okay, well, the thing is, yeah, I totally get the idea that Tesla and Elon Musk are in New World Order operatives. You know, I totally get this. I also know that, like, the internet was created by DARPA, but I use it because it's a handy gadget, and I try to make something good out of the technology they use for enslavement. Now, in this case, my goal has been for years to be out of the oil system, which I think is a slave system, right? They own it. You have to give them a little bit of money if you want to travel around. And this is just chronic. So the idea with electric cars is mainly conceptual. I have like solar panels, and I've had an electric car for 7 years. The problem is we had like a Leaf, which has very limited range. So we couldn't go anywhere. We couldn't, to go to like Los Angeles would be a 2-day trip, which is 100 miles away. So this the new cars have a really incredible range. And just to show you how committed I am to the concept of, of energy independence, I don't use, or at least I actually have used it, but I intend in the future to not use it, the Tesla electricity. What I actually have is like a network of friends that have electric cars. And so as I travel, say I'm hoping to visit a friend in Oregon. And I have people along the way that have electric chargers that I could use. And then they would use mine if they come south. So this is I understood the criticism, but just wanted to explain my position. I'm not sure this will make anybody happy. But one thing that makes me feel happy and safe, Tim, is that the U.S. is a member of NATO, which, purports to be helping the world, be a peaceful place, a place we all want to live in. And I know for a fact that one of us actually knows quite a bit about NATO, having written a paper on it, and that's not me. Now, Tim, can you help us, understanding through the paper that you wrote a few years back, what we need to know about NATO?
Oh, it was just my 2 cents worth on the organization. But of course, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, is also called the North Atlantic Alliance. This is from Wikipedia. Is an intergovernmental military alliance between 29 North American and European countries. The organization implements the North Atlantic Treaty that was signed on 4 April 1949. NATO constitutes a system of collective defense whereby its independent member states agree to mutual defense in response to an attack by an external party. NATO headquarters are located in Haren, Brussels, Belgium, while the headquarters of Allied Command Operations is in near Mons, Belgium. Since its founding, the admission of new member states has increased the alliance from the original 12 countries to 29. That's after the dissolution of the Soviet Union. So it's gotten bigger since its primary reason for existing went away. The most recent member state to be added to NATO is Montenegro on 5 June 2017. NATO currently recognizes Bosnia, Herzegovina, Georgia, Macedonia, and Ukraine as aspiring members. Anyone who kind of knows their geography knows that can be kind of, it gets provocative vis-a-vis Russia, Ukraine, and Georgia, right? An additional 21 countries participate in NATO's Partnership for Peace program, with 15 other countries involved in institutionalized dialogue programs. The combined military spending of all NATO members constitutes over 70% of the global total. Members have committed to reach or maintain defense spending of at least 2% of GDP by 2024, that's a whole lot of money flowing into the military-industrial complex. NATO, my 2 cents worth is, let me see if we can find the piece. Way down here. Bear with me. Sometimes you put something in your notes. Oh, yeah. Well, here, NATO. The myths of NATO. I wrote this a while back, so it's a bit dated, but it's still relevant. Well, according to Cold War Orthodoxy, the United States and its 11 Western European, I'm sorry, according to Cold War Orthodoxy, yeah, according to Cold War Orthodoxy, the United States and 11 Western European nations formed NATO in 1949 to deter Soviet aggression and contain Soviet influence within the boundaries of the Eastern Bloc. But if NATO was solely a defensive military alliance, why didn't it declare mission accomplished and disband after the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991? Well, the answer to that question could be that, like any other government bureaucracy, NATO had no desire to disband, so the bureaucrats in Brussels adapted to new circumstances by broadening their mission. No longer confined to defending Western Europe from the Red Army, NATO's mission was broadened to ensuring peace and security and providing full-spectrum crisis management. Such a nebulous mission statement has given the U.S.-led military alliance a multiplicity of pretext for intervention anywhere in the world. NATO now has operations in Afghanistan, Kosovo, North Africa, and Somalia. The so-called war on terror has given NATO a new rationale as well. Days after the 9/11 attacks, NATO invoked Article 5 of its charter, which declares that an attack on any one member is considered an attack on all members. This was a pretext for NATO's support for the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, and as a justification for its participation in the continued occupation of that country. NATO has utility for U.S. policymakers. The 29-member alliance is often used by the United States to put a multilateral veneer on what are really unilateral actions taken by Washington. U.S. presidents have also found NATO to be useful in circumventing Congress in their conduct of American foreign policy. Bill Clinton's undeclared and illegal war against Serbia in 1999 was done under the auspices of NATO, as was Barack Obama's recent regime change operation in Libya. Another factor in NATO's continuing existence is the influence of the military-industrial complex. The procurement of weapons systems by NATO members transfers billions of dollars into the coffers of the nation's military contracting behemoths. Perhaps this explains why many of these firms have been supportive of NATO's expansion since the end of the Cold War. NATO's membership has grown by more than 75% from 16 to 29 members, since the dissolution of the Soviet Union. The expansion has involved the incorporation of all the former non-Soviet Warsaw Pact member states, the former Soviet republics, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, two former Yugoslav republics, Slovenia and Croatia, and Albania. NATO even had designs on Ukraine and Georgia until Russia signaled that it would not tolerate such a move. NATO supposedly exists to promote security and peace in Europe, but its eastward expansion since 1999 has been extremely provocative and has heightened tensions with Russia. The decision by NATO and the United States to deploy military personnel and aircraft to member nations bordering on Russia is the primary reason Moscow suspended the Treaty on Conventional Armed Forces in Europe in 2007. It was the prospect of joining NATO that emboldened Georgia into provoking a military confrontation with Russia in 2008. In fact, the situation in Europe when NATO was founded in the late 1940s was itself a predictable and direct consequence of Allied war aims. Historian Ralph Rako writes that after World War II, the Soviet Union would be a predominant in Europe was inevitable given the goals pursued by Roosevelt and Churchill. Germany's unconditional surrender and the total annihilation is a factor in the balance of power. At Yalta, the two Western leaders acquiesced in the control over Eastern Europe that had been won by Stalin's armies, while affecting to believe that the Red Dictator would cheerfully assent to the establishment of democratic governments in that area. The trouble was that generally free elections east of the Elbe, except in Czechoslovakia, would inescapably produce bitterly anti-communist regimes. Such a result was unacceptable to Stalin, whose position was well known and much more realistic than the illusions of his erstwhile allies. As he stated in the spring of 1945, whoever occupies a territory also imposes its own social system as far as his armies can reach. The balance of power at the onset of the Cold War was heavily in favor of the United States, which had emerged from World War II in a position of unprecedented economic and military ascendancy. Russia, on the other hand, had suffered grievously from her struggle with Nazi Germany and was in no position to wage another war. British Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery confirmed this view when he wrote to General Eisenhower after visiting Russia in 1947, "The Soviet Union is very, very tired. Devastation in Russia is appalling, and the country is in no fit state to go to war." Russian diplomats were anxious to make a deal with the West and would allow for the rebuilding of the war-shattered country. As for Joseph Stalin, he was certainly a tyrant, but that had little relevance to international politics. Even with the most blood-drenched dictators often pursue real politics and foreign policy. Historian Walter Lefebvre observed, "However Stalin acted like in Russia, However, Stalin acted inside Russia, where he had total control. In his foreign policy during 1941 to 1946, he displayed realism, a careful calculation of forces, a diplomatic finesse that undercut any attempt to explain why his actions as paranoid. Stalin's desire for a Russian sphere of influence in Eastern Europe was reasonable. The invasions that had so devastated his country had come from hostile Eastern European countries. His demand that Turkey permit the transit of Soviet warships through the straits was merely a revival of a traditional Russian claim. Stalin had also honored his agreement with Churchill regarding Greece and had promptly withdrawn his armies from Iran after receiving oil concessions. Republican Senator Robert Taft, surveying the post-war situation, said, "No Russian military attack is threatened in Western Europe, and I certainly do not pretend to understand the Russian mind. But for 4 years, they have shown an intention of making a military advance. They have shown no intention of making a military advance beyond the zones of influence in Central Europe and Manchuria allotted to them at Yalta." Henry Wallace, a former vice president and cabinet member of the Truman administration, agreed with Senator Taft's analysis. He said in a speech in New York, "We have no business in the political affairs of Eastern Europe than Russia has in the political affairs of Latin America, Western Europe, and the United States. Whether we like it or not, Russia will try to socialize their sphere of influence, just as we try to democratize our sphere of influence." President Truman ignored Wallace and Senator Taft, and instead he took the advice of Senator Arthur Vandenberg, who told him to scare the hell out of the American people. These events roughly coincided with the publication of an important article in Foreign Affairs, which supported Truman's confrontational approach vis-a-vis Russia. The Source of Soviet Conduct, written by diplomat and historian George F. Kennan, argued that the Soviet regime was fanatically expansionist and that its influence needed to be contained in the areas of strategic importance to the United States. Kennan wrote, "The main element of any United States policy toward the Soviet Union must be that of long-term, patient, but firm and vigilant containment of Russian expansive tendencies. Soviet pressure against the free institutions of the Western world is something that can be contained by the adroit and vigilant application of counterforce at a series of constantly shifting geographical and political points, corresponding to the shifts and maneuvers of Soviet policy, but which cannot be charmed or talked out of existence." But there was scant evidence supporting Kennan's alarmist vision of a hungry Russian bear needing to be caged. As John Lewis Gaddis writes, "Stalin is now seen as a cagey but insecure opportunist, taking advantage of such tactical opportunities as arose to expand Soviet influence, but without any long-term strategy for even very much interest in promoting the spread of communism beyond the Soviet sphere." Kennan soon became his own critic, repudiating the ideas he put forth in his polemic. But its concepts became received doctrine and continued to shape U.S. foreign policy for the next 40-plus years. Kennan, for his part, would go on to serve in multiple diplomatic posts, but he was marginalized in favor of cold warriors like Dean Acheson, John Foster Dulles, and Paul Nitze. The truth is, NATO's creation in 1949 was part of a wider geopolitical plan that had been drawn up in Washington long before the end of World War II, envisioning the establishment of a world-spanning American political and military empire. As Christopher Lane writes in his The Peace of Illusions, American Grand Strategy from 1940 to the present, "Even during World War II, U.S. policymakers were laying the grand strategic foundations for a post-war international system in which U.S. power would be predominant. Even during World War II and its immediate aftermath, the United States aspired to be the preponderant power in the international system and to make sure there was no rivals that could challenge it. The fear-mongering by U.S. foreign policymakers regarding international communism was necessary because without it, the American people never would have accepted such a radical reversal in their country's foreign policy." U.S. Secretary of State John Foster Dulles admitted as much at the time, saying, "In order to make the country bear the burden, we have to create an emotional atmosphere akin to wartime psychology. We have to create the idea of a threat from without, hence the Red Scare of the 1950s and the wider Cold War. The suspicion that the Soviet Union was a mere pretext for Washington's imperial ambitions is further substantiated by the National Security Council Memorandum number 68. This formally classified 1950 policy document stated that the military superiority was a policy which the United States would probably pursue even if there were no Soviet Union. It should be remembered that war is often a self-perpetuating industry. The billions of dollars spent on manufacturing weapons and other war-related materiel creates special interests that have no desire to see their swords beaten in their plowshares. America's participation in the Second World War spawned the powerful bureaucratic structures and wove a network of financial interests that were unwilling to be dismantled once peace arrived in 1945. The arsenal of democracy had become the military-industrial complex. Moreover, U.S. policymakers in the 1940s mistakenly viewed a permanent warfare state as a way to create permanent prosperity. Since 1950, when NSC 68 was implemented, huge military expenditures have been a regular feature of the U.S. economy. The economic fallacies underlying the system of military Keynesianism have become all too apparent in recent years as the U.S. economy strains under an enormous debt burden, for which decades of military spending bear much responsibility. In recent years, the absence of a countervailing power have encouraged the United States and its allies to lunge forward, exposing NATO for what it truly is, an aggressive global military alliance. So there it is.
Wow. Well, first of all, A+. What year did you write that in?
Well, that was spring of 2012.
Okay. I think that at that point that was, you know, about, certainly it was pretty, I would have that perspective, though not as well informed as the paper was. But I have over the years come to a different position on NATO. I now see NATO as a giant mass of steaming Freemason dung. I don't really see it as a political force. I just see I see it as part of the dialectic. You know, in the paper you were talking about, like, Keenan, you know, was writing that we have to, like, see the Soviets as dangerous, and so this is being presented as a, you know, kind of, he has reasonable grounds for us being alert, and he wants to keep the citizenry on edge, right? He talks about this, you know, we gotta stay ready to head off the bear, even if he's not ready to fight us right now. And then Stalin was, at one point, the paper described Stalin as sort of not having a lot of resources, but cagey and just trying to get what he could get. Well, I just look at the world differently. I would think that the reason that we had the partition at the end of World War II was to set up the Ukrainian Holodomor. I think that was really what was in back of Yalta and, this perplexing, acquiescence of the Soviets to rule in Eastern Europe, or Russia, basically, to rule in Eastern Europe. It made no sense militarily. I mean, Patton pointed all this out, you know, that it was it would be easy to prevent, and there'd be enormous advantages in having those European countries under, a democratic so-called Western society. But it didn't happen. And, you had all of the, not just the Holodomor, but which was the, you know, people are unfamiliar, it was the era in Ukraine that was, and West, that were starved to death, and 12 million people died. This was the third of the series of genocides that the Freemasons had orchestrated, you know, the first being World War I, the second World War II, and then the Holodomor being, and I'm pronouncing the word right, as I've been corrected so many times on my pronunciation. Anyway, so that's how I see it. So NATO was, I think it was just part of the propaganda. And, you know, I will, there's two things I want to talk about, Tim. First is, you really get a chance to look inside NATO with Operation Gladio.
Yes.
Because there you have documents, you know, and there you can see that this idea of, like, stay behind networks, you know, that they said that they were setting up for, you know, they had some kind of quasi, espionage purpose for them, you know.
Yeah, and developed out of the Special Operation Executive Plan, which is a British plan. Which goes back to your idea of NATO being originally Freemasonic, as British Imperial. But the Special Operations Executive had kind of developed this plan during World War II, and then they kind of applied it to the Cold War situation.
Right. And it's just that there was kind of, because then, and then you talk a lot about the strategy of tension, and that it relates to this operation. But the point is that NATO was completely involved with this. There, you know, the NATO documentation is just completely well established by all of the papers that they found. And what you have is that the operation, which supposedly was a NATO operation, I mean, basically, you know, Gladio wasn't, it's hard to imagine, but it wasn't really on its face a Masonic operation, even though it turns out it's what it was. But it's supposed to be NATO's idea of a secret army doing, you know, subversive and criminal stuff to try to keep tension going so that the commies wouldn't get too comfortable in some areas and that people would, in other countries that were, you know, under the threat purportedly of like being attracted to communism, you know, they would look to a stronger, you know, Christian government to protect them. You know, there were these different ideas. But in fact, it was just really just the secret army was just there to enforce Masonic control. They found that in the documents that this NATO operation was actually being run out of this P2 lodge, mm-hmm. and that the one Italian general who was a NATO member, supposedly, and three of the heads of the intelligence services in the Italian government were all members of this P2 lodge. Mm-hmm. So what are we talking about here? I mean, it's as if that the you know, the Masonic power is just slightly hidden by NATO. You see what I mean? It's just so that's there's one other thing I want to talk about, but I wanted you to respond to that because I know you actually know a lot about Operation Gladio. So what do you think? Was NATO exposed by Operation Gladio?
Well, yeah. I mean, a while back I had an opportunity to actually interview Danielle Gensler, who wrote the book NATO Secret Armies. And this book has been remarkable in the fact it's been so ignored by the corporate media. But when it came out, in, I think around 2007, it covered this covert operation being run by NATO and also the various intelligence services. And, of course, the CIA denies it. But their documents linking the CIA as well. Of course, they always have some sort of deniability in these things. They claim everything is forged. But basically, the Gladio operation, the sort of this idea of covert operations capability, was developed in the late 50s, not too long after NATO was formed, in order to, so much, you know, be able to carry out operations if should the Red Army invade. You know, come through the Folger Gap and take Western Europe. But as the situation sort of developed in the 1960s and is clear that an invasion wasn't coming, these covert operations, sort of terrorist operations being carried out in target countries like Italy or Belgium or Germany to create false flag terrorist operations as part of a strategy of tension to have an effect on domestic politics. So the country's politics would be more in line with the interest of NATO and perhaps in the intelligence agencies. So to create the strategy of fear, that's kind of what that one Gladio operator, and Gladio was the operation in Italy. It goes by other names in Belgium and Germany and these things, but we call it Gladio, sort of a catch-all. But the one participant was Vincenzo Verguerra, I think was his name, and he said the idea was you had to target children, women, civilians, to create the strategy of tension, to create fear, so people cling to the government. And this is what it did. It did change the politics. Well, you had the various bombings in Italy, like the train bombing or bombing in Rome, or you had the Brabant massacres, where you had these random shootings in malls in Belgium, just to create fear. And so this is what was going on, and there were various investigations, judicial and also parliamentary investigations, in Switzerland, in Belgium, and in Italy, I think, were the countries that looked into it. The United States refused to participate in it, but enough was revealed. Then they were suppressed under the guise of national security. The investigations were quashed. But enough was exposed that this was a reality, that you had, instead of the Red Army or a lot of these terrorist operations were blamed on red factions. It turns out that it wasn't. There was this Gladio operation that was made up of sort of residual fascist elements, Masonic, you know, obviously organized through the Masonic Lodge, the P2 Lodge in Italy, and conducted by the Western intelligence agencies to carry out false flag attacks against their own citizens. and says a lot, and that kind of exposes sort of the, well, the fraud of NATO.
Yeah.
You know.
And I just have one more little bonbon. Last week we talked about Franz Ferdinand's license plate.
Yes.
Which was A111118. And I mentioned that I had received awareness of it from someone who corresponds with me, and they had told me about it, and I was unaware of it. And last week I hadn't actually seen any evidence other than this very reliable person's testimony about it. But as I sent you in an email and a link, and I'm going to ask someone, please post this in the comments, the YouTube comments about this show, because my opinion, this is the most important physical piece of evidence that we have in terms of the nature of the world. And it's a picture. And if you just type in, you know, A111118, it will pop right up. A strange coincidence. Franz Ferdinand license plate in Armistice Day.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a picture of it with the license plate staring right at you. You can see the numbers. And it says, do you know that the Archduke's number read A111118? A series that can be read Armistice 11 November 1918. And particularly since actually A and Armistice, A was a designation for Armistice in the media. When it was achieved. So anyway, this is my point. Is that this cannot possibly be circumstance. You know, we've looked at all the Masonic influence coming from Quattro Coronati in the Second World War, and when you see something like this, obviously this is not circumstance. But my point is this: what does it tell us? What does it mean? Well, if they can orchestrate before the war ends the date that it ends, it means that the dialectic is, as I have been suggesting all of these months, fake. That the world wars were, in fact, simply processes by which Europeans were genocided. That's all they were. To do that without basically being caught doing it, they needed to, you know, establish elaborate dialectics. You had to, you know, have create Adolf Hitler, and you know, and you had to. In World War One, I don't know exactly how they got it rolling, but they had entangling alliances, right? So in any event, the fact that before the war began, they knew the date it would end, shows that they certainly are in charge of both sides of it. And I wanted to also point out that the date itself is, you know, is not just shows awareness, but I mean, as everyone, I presume everyone is aware that, you know, you have the number 11 being highlighted in the concluding date of World War One. And again, this shows that that this is, you know, something that is being controlled by the Masons. And the, you know, so the number 11 is an occult number. And Patrick O'Carroll, who I believe he's a Catholic gentleman, sent me and said I could use his name. He sent me the awareness of the license plate. And he also pointed out that Aleister Crowley had said that 11 is the number of black magic in itself and therefore suitable for all types of operations, you know, occult and otherwise. And so, you know, if you look at, I mean, the things, you know, like the Fukushima, you know, nuclear disaster, the September 11th, the day that the Pentagon groundbreaking, you know, these things, you know, make people aware that the 11, the number 11 is it's a marker. You know, it's just something that they put on these things to show that they are in control of them. And excuse me, the number 11, I'll just take one little example and then I'll stop. It's just that if you look at September 11th, right, the first plane to hit the building was Flight 11.
Yes.
I mean, Flight 11 had 92 passengers, 9 plus 2 equals 11. And the next flight was Flight 77. You know, that's the other Masonic. And it had 65 passengers, 6 plus 5 is 11. The Twin Towers had 110 floors, or 110 floors, right? Yeah. So 11 was just, you know, this is just, you know, the beginning of it. I can go on.
There's, and of course, the Twin Towers, right?
The Twin Towers look like an 11. And it just goes on and on. So they had wired the number 11 into this thing. And so when you see the beginning of the war, with the license plate, Tim, my point is just, they're just laughing at us, you know, with this kind of stuff. They just think, well, these people are so stupid that even symbolism, which is obviously artificial, and his meaning is just transparent to anyone who does a little research, they're not going to be able to understand. I mean, I really think it's up to us to, one of the ways that hopefully we can get more people to be aware of our circumstance, or the plight that we're facing, the fact that the government is basically a secret society, that democracy does not penetrate, and that genocide is the goal and we are the target. I mean, little problems like this is show them stuff like the license plate, because I would just think that, when you talk to a normie, when you talk to them about NATO, Operation Gladio, a lot of times, I'm sure you've had this experience, Tim, their eyes just glaze over. It's like you've hit some kind of a numb zone, right, where they just can't see anything that's worth recognizing or worth worrying about. But show them the license plate and see if that just wakes somebody up. Because that's not circumstance. That is someone who knows the end of the date of the war before it begins. And then if you go into the whole assassination process, which is Masonic, I don't know, Tim. I mean, do you think it's, you know, that the license plate will help wake people up, or is it just too vague?
Well, just another coincidence.
No defense against the coincidence argument. It's just too powerful.
It's just one of these things. That happened. It just, it's funny, odd thing of history. Another thing regarding Gladio, of course, Sybil Edmonds has talked about, we're talking about Gladio sort of in terms of history, but there's also, she talks about Gladio, part B, or 2.0, Gladio B, or 2.0, whatever. It's the use of how, now they're using jihadi terrorists.
Right.
To spread fear. And Islamic jihadists, and what it's done is they've used them to create turmoil, spread fear, and also create a conduit for drugs, the same way that maybe the Red Army cutouts were used, or at least they were blamed for these terrorist attacks, and how it was really be done by these Gladio operators. But this idea you see now, this has been done since the 1990s in the Balkans, how NATO was used jihadists flying them in from Saudi Arabia, the Middle East, Afghanistan, to stoke a war in the Balkans to tear apart Yugoslavia, and Yugoslavia was systematically taken apart by the Western powers in the 1990s, kind of create these areas of instability so these areas could be exploited, human trafficking, drugs. And not only just also giving NATO a reason to exist, and also to weaken Russia, because at the same time you also had these same jihadists were being shipped into Chechnya to destabilize Chechnya and provoke a war there. Now again, there's some people suggest that even the Russian government exploited this situation to carry out its own false flag attacks in Russia, these infamous apartment bombings. So states use these conflicts for reasons of propaganda and also as strategies of tension. The whole area is being destabilized. A good point is, everyone watches CNN and people have seen that guy Robert Baer on. He'll come on and give us 2 cents worth in some area. He's a former CIA. He's on as a former CIA operative. But he himself admits back in the early 90s that his job was going into the Balkans and stirring up trouble, creating sort of, you know, getting different factions fighting, and in order to create a one group to respond to another. I suspect that massacres were carried out, blamed on other groups to create another massacre. And this is kind of what the strategy was in the Balkans, was when the Milosevic, who was the Serb, was blamed for being the new Hitler or something, for trying to keep his country together, although his methods were nowhere near as brutal as Abraham Lincoln, but he was still called a horrible tyrant. But the Western powers went in and stoked a Muslim rebellion to tear apart Serbia, to fight for Kosovo's secession from Serbia. And all this was done to more or less stoke, foment a civil war. And this was when NATO started bombing in 1999, when Bill Clinton ordered that war. Despite Congress's explicit objection. So this is what you have, and again, you have sort of this unilateral, unaccountable military force that can be used to wage war. It's interesting, during that war, the United Nations stated that it had authority, that it said that NATO should seek its approval for the war. And NATO said, we don't need UN approval. They just went out and conducted it unilaterally. But it's interesting, at the time, they were critical of the United Nations. Well, the United Nations was simply doing its job. It's there to prevent wars between states. So here you have the UN, which itself is sort of a globalist setup anyway, but nevertheless, NATO says, no, we don't, UN has no authority. Well, that's the purpose of the UN. And it's interesting to point that NATO itself had no jurisdiction involving itself in an internal struggle. But nevertheless, it sort of invoked this authority unilaterally. The same thing it did with Libya, many years later in 2011, under the, the doctrine of responsibility to protect, RTP, which is just a pretext for intervention to destabilize, overthrow a government, and seize its resources and create havoc and create the migration crisis across the Mediterranean. The same thing NATO is doing in Syria right now. It's been caught, supporting groups like ISIS, supposedly this terrorist organization that the West is fighting. It's actually receiving support from NATO and also from Turkey, which is also a NATO member. And that's being done to wage to foment a civil war in Syria, to again just create to destabilize the regime there, perhaps, or just to create an environment of instability, war. So you have refugees, you have people escaping, creating a sort of demographic or migration pressure on Europe, which makes these countries become inundated with people who aren't from that area, like Syrians or Somalis. We talked about this recently, Somalians in Sweden or something, people from North Africa, and create sort of that demographic warfare. So it's a broad-based plan. It's interesting enough that, of course, the former commander of NATO, General Wesley Clark, as a commander of NATO, he said that the days of the ethnic-based European state are over.
He's a real hero of the European. You can see what a great thing it is to have NATO. I mean, when you have the commander saying, your ethnicity is going to be destroyed. That's don't complain about that. Yeah. Well, I mean, there it is. It's the real problem with NATO, or one of them, is that basically it's just a kind of Praetorian guard for the oligarchs. So they have a problem. In some ways, with the armies that are under direct government control. And so with NATO, I mean, who controls NATO, right? Obama used NATO for the Afghanistan adventure, and then they also used NATO, I mean, like you pointed out, in Serbia. But then Look at how NATO was used against Gaddafi.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, you know, when you don't want to have democratically controlled troops do something really crazy like the, you know, Gaddafi adventure, you have NATO. NATO can come in there and get the ball rolling.
Mm-hmm.
It can get enough violence occurring so that then the democratically controlled parts of the army can come, are forced to come in and destroy massive quantities of civilians. And so NATO is just, you know, it's as evil as can be, really. It's there is the process of control is, you know, artificial. It's obviously that, I mean, the P2 documents show that it's just, you know, controlled by the Masonic world.
Well, you're familiar with the connection of, like, the Dutroux affair, that the sexual scandal, the, you know, Mark Dutroux, who was caught trafficking with children, kidnapping girls and these things, and owning several houses or dungeons.
And yeah.
He was trafficking, or he would procure these girls for various high government officials in Belgium, and some say even members of NATO. And what this reveals is that although we have a command structure in NATO, they're appointed in this revolving command structure, it's all very official, these things. Behind the scenes, and this is the important of, like, something with P2, with the propaganda due in Italy, is you have just behind the scenes sort of a parallel command structure. And what we're seeing here is that human trafficking, pedophilia, these sex scandals is a way that these organizations are suborned or controlled from behind the scenes, the same way that human compromise is used here in various countries to undermine parliaments and congresses and legislatures and government officials and judges. And this is something that the intelligence agencies are involved in, all intelligence agencies are involved in, is using these tactics or strategies to control the officials who are supposedly appointed to serve, you know, the people and the governments. But they're really, because of human trafficking and drugs and these things, highly compromised, is that the system really serves the secret society, because that's how it's controlled. You have human compromise. You also have, with NATO, surprise, surprise, everywhere you see a NATO operation, you often see massive drug operations and also human trafficking, illegal arms shipments and these things. This is, you know, part of it has to be the primary reason why NATO is still controlling Afghanistan, because of the opium crop there, and how the secret society, these criminal organizations, the criminal syndicate, if you will, controls international drug trade, and of course the money that flows from that into the banking system and these things. And so it's, although we have an official veneer, just behind the scenes, if you look at it, you have a vast criminal enterprise that's really controlling it.
Yeah, and you know, they, since they own the federal banks, they, you know, money is not difficult for them to get in any amounts they want. You know, world domination is the nature of their game, or as Mick Jagger sang about Lucifer, you know, what is puzzling you is the nature of my game.
Yeah.
Well, it's clear when the Freemason General Haig orders his troops to march into automatic weapon fire. I was reading, you know, a report about this, and the Germans were astounded that they were, you know, this was the Battle of Somme, I believe, or I guess this is what led up to Verdun. But anyway, a million people were killed. I mean, that's a lot of bodies. But the Germans were astounded that the so-called Allies would march in slowly and just in straight lines so that they could be mowed down by automatic weapons. The Haig's master plan was to bomb the Germans and then send in the troops. And the bombs didn't penetrate anywhere near the, you know, where they were actually hiding in the trenches. And so when the troops came, all they found were automatic weapons, and they just got mowed down like 10 pins. The rate of death was like 50,000 an hour. Pretty amazing, right? But then when you go forward and you see, well, here comes NATO. NATO, again, is like, you know, like has this idea of respectability. You know, there's this the Soviets. We've got to keep them in check and we need to organize ourselves. But all it really does is create an army that is outside of any kind of democratic scrutiny. Mm-hmm. And then the first thing that gives us a look into the inside is the P2 Lodge's documents, which show that it's just that the government is, not just in Italy, but all of the different, the Vatican was exposed. All of these mm-hmm. things were exposed as just being part of this organization that floats above mankind.
And all the governments proved completely powerless to prosecute and go after the
anything. Yeah. Isn't that incredible? Yeah. I mean, they just couldn't do a thing about it. In fact, I think one of the guys who was named ended up as the prime minister of Italy like 15 years later or something.
Berlusconi, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just a complete cesspool.
And he's a media mogul, I think, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Does he have like a Jersey Shore Italian style? I mean, so this is, this is just, history is ridiculous. I noticed that I'm getting a lot of people, and they are people who try to take the position that Hitler is misunderstood, that there was really something, that their position is that he really wasn't, the Holocaust creator against the Jews, that he was really trying to stand up against New World Order. And, he banned the Freemasons, so he can't possibly be, a pawn in this system. Well, to me, that's, you can show just basically everyone involved at a level that of control is related into the group. The idea that this one individual would not be and then decide, well, I'm going to just fight down to the last man, the perfect foil to Churchill who wanted to kill the last man. This is just analytically ridiculous.
Well, lot of this is, if you look at someone referred to NATO as the idea was to keep Germany down and Russia out. Now, what that really is, is that's the Mackinder Doctrine.
Yeah.
And when we talk about Germany and Russia, we don't say because Germany and Russia oppose a physical barrier because of these countries' geographical positions. This is the idea of being strong continental powers challenging the sea power, Leviathan, which is the Anglo-American Empire. It isn't to say that Stalin and Hitler were good guys at different phases. It just means that the reality is as the chess pieces are being moved on the board, the Masonic board, because of the reality of Russia as an entity, as a state, or Germany as a people, as an identity, these things present an obstacle to the New World Order. This Anglo-American Zio New World Order to dominate the world. So they're going to have to be, put down and challenged. A good example is, NATO's idea was that NATO was there to keep the Red Army at bay. Because the Red Army was a threat. Well, the Red Army goes away, the Soviet Union dissolves, and in the ensuing years, Russia starts to develop a mutual beneficial trade position with Europe, and perhaps even with China. And this ordinarily, you might say, well, this is a good thing, right? Because nations are trading and these things, and this will help development. Yeah, but this is a challenge to the full spectrum dominance objective of the Anglo-American Zio Empire, the New World Order, which is Freemasonic. So new excuses or pretexts have to be created to create an atmosphere of tension. Not maybe an atmosphere of full shooting war. I don't think we're going to get that. This is an atmosphere of constant tension, so these countries can be kept off balance. You got to maintain the dollar for now as a reserve currency, so you can't have Russia trading with Europe or China and creating some sort of condominium that challenges Anglo-American power. This broadly speaking, this is the Mackinder Doctrine. This is kind of what we're seeing today with conflicts and these things, stoking a conflict with Russia. This isn't to say that Putin is a good guy and Russia isn't infiltrated. I think it is. This government's infiltrated and they don't have their own. It's hard to, there's no real good guy here. But nevertheless, the geopolitics is still there, still relevant, I think, regardless of the governments. And the governments, you know, since 1917, the government in Russia has largely been installed by the Western powers. You know, with the Bolsheviks, and even today's Russian government, although I think there's elements that resist the West, it's largely infiltrated, but it still finds its identity is still, you know, with, you know, Putin is still, you know, with Russia, the Soviet Union, and these things. So it's a mixed bag. It's not clear. But nevertheless, I do think that you do have the reason why Germany has to be ethnically, sort of psychologically conquered, have their sort of psychologically decapitated and be demonized, is because you don't want them to have a proud sense of identity. So this is the function of World War II and the Holocaust narrative and these things. So they don't have the self-confidence to assert themselves in these things. So that's kind of what we're seeing today, and why, you know, any attempt by China and Russia to start some sort of trade agreement is going to be looked at very askance at by the West, and it's going to be suppressed because they want to maintain the dominance of international commerce and trade to control the world. And so you see this back and forth struggle going on geopolitically. Who's to say at what point it's being controlled? I don't know, but it's there. So
yeah, I mean, I kind of, that's kind of how I see it. I think that the kind of the important thing for a citizen to understand is that when you see something like you know, like the creation of the Soviet bloc, mm-hmm. right? You have the end of World War II, and then you have the Soviet bloc. Well, the Soviet bloc was part of the rationale for the existence of NATO.
Yeah, dialectically.
Okay. Yeah, so these proxy countries, and the Russia's in there, and they're radicalizing them. They're communists, and we need to have a buffer, just like the Russians do. You know, so we have NATO. Well, you know, that's what's given to the public. It kind of makes some sense. Or, I mean, maybe, I don't know. If that was the case, you'd think that NATO would have gone out of existence with the end of the Soviet Union, but it just became more and more dominant in Europe. So this kind of contradicts the idea that the basic narrative was real. But however you want to slice it, at the end of the day, the area that the Holocaust was going to move into, where the genocide of the European, which has been working its way across the continent, you know, starting in France with the, you know, the trenches in World War II, and then moving into Germany, where you have the German people firebombed and the, you know, and destroyed, and then it's going to, in the you know, it's going to move then east into the areas of the Soviet bloc countries. And I just take the position that it's that, you know, which, when you look at A111118, that World War I was artificial. When you look at the relationships between the Nazi Party and Quattro Coronati and Helen Blavatsky, you can see that World War II was artificial. These are just, you know, narratives so that the ruling group will be able to have an excuse to genocide Europeans. But then when they move east and you have the Holodomor, I think that this is, you know, that's the best explanatory framework. And so the there's geopolitics. It's there. They use it in the narratives. But I just think that the body counts are just so astronomical, and the rationale, or like, you know, Haig is ordering these guys to slow motion walk across the battlefield in automatic weapon. It's just so obvious to me that they're just trying to reduce population. That's just how I look at it. When I look at NATO, and I look at the Soviet bloc, you know, and what did they used to call it? The Red Curtain?
Iron Curtain.
The Iron Curtain, right? They have that expression. I mean, I think all that's happened is that they've created a zone of privacy and a narrative whereby they can genocide the population, and the world doesn't realize what they're doing. I mean, I think you know, it's like what's puzzling us is, you know, the nature of their game. You know, this is Mick Jagger speaking for Lucifer. So I think
what's sort of ironic is you look at the Iron Curtain. And of course, at the time, it was the propaganda from the Soviet Union was that it was necessary to protect the East from the West. And in retrospect, that wasn't completely false, because if you, the poison, the toxic culture of the West has became more toxified in the 60s and 70s. And if you look at today, the countries that are most, I guess, assertive in their culture and ethnicity and tradition are those countries in the East, like Hungary, right, or Romania, and these and Poland, where there's some semblance of ethnic identity.
Well, I think people with European backgrounds still seem to have some kind of political life and future.
Yeah,
and I agree. It's ironic, isn't it, that you know, like the areas that were used to be and behind so-called Iron Curtain are now, you know, where there is still looks like some thriving European ethnicity. But I think it's just a matter of time before they get around to wiping that out. I mean, when you look at our statistics of a couple of weeks ago concerning Sweden, I mean, this could be done in Spain and in Germany and France. Gee whiz, I was in France a couple of years ago, Tim. We drove through the country. My wife is completely fluent in French, so we get to, you know the people where, and she's lived there before, and we have friends. Oh my God. I mean, they were combining like four and five former cities into one school district because there were no children. I mean, the entire core of France is barren.
Yeah, and if you have a people who simply don't want to procreate, there's no future by definition, right? I mean, that's part of the effect of the last century on Europe. You know, sort of the sexual revolution that was imposed. We talked about this in Sweden, same in Germany, and sort of this so they were drained, literally drained white. France was at Verdun in these things, and they never quite recovered demographically. But really, after the Second World War, this is why existentialism took hold in these things in the middle of the 20th century in France. Sort of the in vogue philosophy then, but it really killed off by the 1970s. It started the morale, the birth rates plummeted in these things, and then this becomes the pretext, you know, for this sort of this Kalergi plan that's apparently being implemented. You know, well, we're not enough people. We've got to bring them into work in these things, as if there's an high unemployment in Europe, isn't there?
Yeah, so. I mean, it's another aspect of genocide. You know, the idea that like existentialism, for example, was organic, I think is, you know, it's another way of kind of expressing my concern in that when I look at Sartre or Genet, people like this, I just think this is fake. This is just Masonic literature. This is like Jackson Pollock painting.
I mean, yeah, it's cultural Cold War stuff. Yeah,
yeah, books like Nausea. I forget some of the books by Genet. I've actually read this guy when I was a kid. I mean, they're just so stupid and so mindless. I mean, they gave a Nobel Prize to Sartre. He wrote Nausea, which, I mean, it's just beyond belief how stupid the book is. All it does is make people feel bad if they take the author seriously. Why in the world was this promoted? It's sort of like, you know, Catcher in the Rye. Mm-hmm. So you know, literature has been weaponized, right? It's that simple. And when you insert really destructive literature into a culture that has been as shattered as the French, you know, World War I, where they lost so much of their population, it has, you know, an amplified effect.
Well, yeah, I mean, direct political revolution, you get reaction, you get a opposition. A cultural revolution through the arts, it's very subtle and gradual, and you undermine the ability to react to the subsequent political revolution that grows from the cultural revolution.
Yeah, what's puzzling us is the nature of their game. You see, we don't get that because they control culture. They basically are able to soften this up intellectually, so we can't, you know, think about what's happening to us. They can soften us up physically, so we can't fight back. I mean, everything has been weaponized to destroy us. So it's a death system for the European. That's what you, when you wake up in the morning, you walk out into the world and you read your propaganda newspaper with the subtle neurolinguistic programming, you know, to like take you off a cliff emotionally so you don't do anything.
But what strikes you about NATO and it's sort of this admission that it had covert operations, these things. The thing is, like you said earlier, there's no accountability for these things. So anyone's guess of what they're doing, they have the capability, right? They have the capability, they have the manpower, the organizational structure to do all types of dastardly evil things behind the scenes and blame it on somebody else, which is what Gladio was. But if you look at situations like it's a way of destroying any real opposition to the oligarchy, because any meaningful opposition, well, you get murdered and people call it a heart attack. Good example was what was that guy Mattei, Enrico Mattei, who was in charge. He prevented Italy's state oil corporation from being privatized by the Seven Sisters in the 1950s. And he's also in the process of negotiating some better deals with some of the oil producing countries. Well, this was ran afoul of the Seven Sisters, and his plane blows up.
Ouch!
You know, so was this a NATO op? Was this a Gladio operation? It might be. It sounds like it. There was that Herrhausen, the German banker, the guy who ran the Deutsche Bank. Now he was kind of in the upper circle. He was the inner circle. He was a Bilderberger banker and these things. But nevertheless, he had proposed debt relief for the third world. And he's kidnapped by some Red Army faction, I think, then murdered. Now, of course, given the context of NATO, Gladio, where they carry out terrorist actions and they blame, a leftist group. Well, I'm a little suspicious of that, of his death. And of course, you also have the Moro, the Italian prime minister, who was supposedly kidnapped by the Red Army, and he claimed, right. It came out that he was threatened by Kissinger in the 90s, and he's kidnapped and murdered. And it turns out that I think that was a Gladio operation, at least that's what some people think. But again, these are figures, political figures, that, you know, they're somewhat in the system, they're operating within the system, and they're suggesting an alternative path, a real debate, change of policy, and this is how the system's controlled, you know. Yeah, there's opposition from time to time. There's people that advocate these things, but if these people get in a position that really thwarts or gets in the way of the oligarchy, the secret society, they're taken out. And
there's different approaches. I'm just going to segue and digress for one second, if you don't mind, because I've been watching this event during the day. And, you know, you have the Omarosa tape scandal that's blown up over the last day or so. I don't know if you've been following this.
I just heard the headlines.
Well, Omarosa was a reality
star
person that ended up in the White House with
Wasn't she from his TV show?
Yeah, she's a reality star person.
And now she's in the cabinet or something?
Well, she was. I mean, I think she was vice president. I don't know. I mean, so she gets in the White House as an actual employee, which shows, you know, this is like a pollution of the political system where the reality people are ending up inside, you know, with basically the job that they won during the reality show kind of that ends up being like the president of the United States. I mean, it's just the whole thing is kind of crazy. But so Omarosa didn't work out. She's a black lady. She runs afoul of Trump. And now she says, if you recall, I predicted that Donald would have a sex tape. Right. With the idea that, you know, they're really pushing, you know, the debasement of politics. But now I'm thinking after this Omarosa thing, I think I may have been wrong. I think that Omarosa claims that she has a tape where Donald uses the N-word. And this has been on every news show during the day.
He called someone a Neanderthal? That's terrible.
The N-word. I mean, this is all this. It's an N-word by Donald. And see, I'm thinking, well, you know, this may actually be a better ploy, because than a sex tape. I mean, a sex tape might actually, I mean, boost his ratings, and I mean, who knows at this point in our culture what would be the response. But, you know, it reminded me like when we did shows on Fatty Weinstein, you know, with the sexual harassment where, you know, the most powerful mogul in Hollywood is brought to his knees because of, you know, the women were able to, you know, like stand together and defeat him. And then at the same time, Bill O'Reilly was caught with some kind of, you know, sexual harassment thing, and he resigned. And so these events, I think, are neuro-linguistic programming. They just beat in the power, the political power and the intimidation of women as rulers, right? Mm-hmm. And the point is that the men who see this will go, gee, I better, you know, like even be more meek and humble and defeatist than ever, because look at the power out there. And I think that with Trump, they may be setting up an N-word event. He might even have to resign, or it could be that it'll just, you know, cause him so much grief, it'll just be a dominating event. But the point is, what is the neurolinguistic programming point of the story in terms of the target group, which I think would be like white males? I think it, you know, when you have the N-word, you know, if you even use it, you know, the president of the United States can be crushed. Then what you have, it's sort of like the confirmation of the cult and the religion of integration that Martin Luther King said, right? You see, so this is what I think these kinds of events are structured as, is that they're very subtle neurolinguistic programming. I think they're completely artificial. And the outrage that will, you know, if in fact a tape does exist, which could tear the country apart, Tim, riots could break out. I mean, you know, there could be just God knows what, because the president used the N-word.
Well, I mean, the president can unilaterally order, you know, a missile attack on a sovereign nation that has waged no war against the United States and perhaps kill people and destroy property overseas. And that's okay. That's part of being presidential, I suppose. But God forbid if he uses a racial slur.
Right.
Or ever use a racial slur. That means he's unfit for office and he should resign or be impeached and convicted in the Senate. A president can be you know, credibly accused of rape and no one seems to care. But if he uses the N-word...
The N-word will definitely... Now you have the riots. And, you know, this is... You know, with like Operation Gladio and the strategy of tension, NATO is sort of a cipher for us to kind of see how our own country is manipulated.
Well, there's Operation Northwoods, right?
Yeah.
You know, which, and interestingly enough, is supposedly this is what caused Kennedy to fire General Lyman Lemitzer because of the proposal. And Kennedy, it doesn't, you know, he sent them to command NATO.
Right,
and this is when the Gladio phase kicked in. Yeah, so yeah. You know, you propose to to wage false flag terror attacks against the United States. Well, I'm going to transfer you. I'm not going to fire you. Yeah. Bring up on charges.
Right. Yeah. So how real is that whole thing? So anyway, it's just like, you know, our show is our discussions is I think one of the things that is valuable about it is that, you know, when we take a structure like NATO, we can relate it, you know, into this broader pattern of how they don't just destroy us with, you know, with weapons. They also destroy us with narratives and with fake history and of course, with things like integration.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, now in France, where you have, you know, a population that has been basically machine gunned and then poisoned, right? And then now is ready to be basically just the final stroke will just be to have no children. And the children are all, you know, immigrant children. And there they, you know, if this group had as a goal the destruction of the European, I mean, they can just check France as one of the boxes, right? So this is what we're up against, you know. This is you know, very serious and tragic situation that we don't know the nature of their game, you know, that the public is, you know, they're sitting there and they're kind of thinking that multiculturalism is a great idea. They're, you know, this will be leading to a better world, and they don't realize that it's just been, it's an artificial construction that was created for this express purpose of genocide.
Yeah. And they actually, again, they destroy real diversity throughout the world, you know, under this globalist concept of integrating and mixing everyone together, because the only way you have ethnic, you know, diversity is you have to have ethnicities.
Right. Right? And they have to actually, and you have multiculturalism when they live near each other.
I mean, if you like Italian food, you have to defend Italian culture. I mean, Italian culture, I mean, in the main, you have to defend the ethnicity, right?
And that, of course.
You know, and so, you know, if you like Chinese food or if you like Thai food, you have to defend Thai culture and ethnicity. You know, I mean, if I walked into a Chinese restaurant and there's, you know, there wasn't a Chinese guy there, staff, I'm going to walk out. I'm sorry. Call me racist.
But well, you're racist.
I want the experience. You know.
Well, don't use the N-word.
Yeah, I don't want to go into an Italian restaurant and, you know, see there's, God forbid, find there's a German cook back there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in California, you can walk into any French restaurant in Southern California and look in the kitchen, and they're all Latinos.
Yeah. That's, yeah. Well, that's New World Order, yeah. California. Yeah,
that's what we have here. So it's, yeah. It's yeah. So anyway, the you know, there are still plenty of us left. We need to express the information clearly to one another. As far as NATO goes, I just think it's a component of a, you know, of a, it was created to accentuate a false dialectic, which the primary purpose was to permit Stalin an iron curtain behind which he could genocide, and so having, you know, softened Europe up, right, with the France, German, and then you know, Eastern European areas being all wiped out, now the New World Order can creep in, you know, with the full Mason crypto kind of you know, power structure. So, you know, they have a puzzling game, but I think we've got the nature of it identified, Tim. And I think that I hope that people will, you know, it's always hard to get perspective on these things. I don't know what's going to really click with people, what will, you know, get them to be so certain that they can say, you know, I'm not going to be intimidated anymore. I am going to speak up about these things. When I look at the license plate, and I hope that there'll be people who post this picture over and over again, I mean, it shows that not only were, like, the Masons in play during the assassination of the Archduke, which everyone knows, I mean, that's actually documented, but they knew the date of the end of the war, which means they controlled both sides. You see, you can't give that date if you don't control both sides.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what the European has to know, is that all of the deaths of World War I were part of the Masonic project of the genocide of the European. And so when you look at NATO, and I mean, it's just a steaming mass of Masons. I mean, I was looking through some of the documentations on the generals, people inside, and they're just a mass of Masons and, you know, Knights of Malta, you know, all of these different pseudo organizations, which are all basically part of the secret society. And then, you know, NATO, which was supposed to defend Europe, but just somehow forgot to do anything at all about the genocide that was about to take place in Eastern Europe. What a shock. Patton was right, mm-hmm. You know, and so the European, man, we just can't get a break. And we're never going to get a break, Tim. And we will be genocided if we don't fight back. We have to organize and get people to realize what's going on and fight back. We have to. Because otherwise, you'll see in like 50 years, there will be slave camps and then out the door. Gone. Just look at the license plate and realize that what we're saying about the artificiality of these world wars and these genocidal famines, how they are, that the narrative that we're given is incorrect, and there's actually organizations that are bringing this about. Now, when you realize that that's real, you have responsibility. go out there and do something, you know, talk to friends, try to organize, get people to be aware of this stuff.
Well, I was, you know, whenever I remember during the war against Serbia in 1999, NATO's war, I would just ask, well, why does NATO still exist if it was there to deter?
Yeah.
Well, it's a new mission, like I said. Well, fine, a new mission, that's great. So how about close up shop and, you know, why are there still U.S., you know, tens of thousands of U.S. forces in Germany, you know, or in Okinawa, for that matter?
It's a dangerous world, Tim. We just need to You know, I was thinking about, like, so the U.S. has, the budget is more than, like, twice the next largest military budget. I think we spend more than everyone else all together put together, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then someone pointed out that, so that's what we spend in terms of our military budget. The rest of the world's military budget, what percentage of that are weapons that we create that we sell?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just we are the merchant of death.
Yeah, that's how the big cycle. So, that's a petrodollar deal with the Saudis and Europe. That's one of the reasons why people like Lockheed Martin was a big advocate of NATO expansion because. If Poland would enter into NATO membership, they'd have to upgrade their military to the standards of NATO, which means selling more weaponry. Yeah,
yeah, it's preposterous, and that's the idea that we're here to defend Europeans, right?
From what?
From what? From ourselves, basically. We're like the idea of like defending Europeans. I just, you know, this is sad. Now, Tim, you know, we need to cut it short tonight because I know it's late there for you. We're recording this on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a busy week ahead. You have a lot of, I know you have a lot of research to do over the next couple of days. So, we won't talk for a while, but, I hope you get a good night's sleep, brother, and wake up in the morning ready to, you know, get some work done.
Okay, Joe, let you go.
All right, buddy. Thank you so much for this, and we'll get them next week. Okay.
Take it easy. Bye-bye.
Right, thanks, Tim. Bye-bye.